And I think Gene's legacy is important on so many levels, not only for the history of classic film, but also for the type of man he was. I think it's also important that people understand that you can be one of the most famous people in the world and you can still be decent and you can value your art and you cannot take your stardom for granted.
A photo of Gene Kelly wearing an Irish flat cap, flashing his signature smile, hangs from a cabinet with care. Atop the cabinet sit various accolades and a beer mug, a gift from Frank Sinatra. Suspended above the cabinet are drawings of Kelly by the great Al Hirschfeld, which frame an aisle of carefully labeled boxes, each filled with memorabilia and original items from Gene's films. Flanking the aisle is another cabinet, displaying, among other things, the roller skates Gene wore in Xanadu. Across from the cabinet, above a desk, is the cup-hilt rapier Gene expertly flourished in The Three Musketeers. On the desk itself are Gene's Singing in the Rain script and sheet music for the film's title number, complete with Gene's handwritten choreography annotations in the margins and above the music notes. These are but a few of the priceless treasures that greeted me as I stepped into the Gene Kelly archives at the home of Gene's widow, film historian Patricia Ward Kelly. I never dreamed that after nearly a lifetime of admiring Gene on screen, of being inspired by his incomparable dancing and multidimensional creative talent, I'd have the chance to sit down with Patricia amidst the cherished belongings that seemed to whisper Gene's story. It was a powerful experience to discuss Gene's life and legacy with the woman he loved, the woman who knew Gene like no one else. Patricia is generous in sharing about her life with Gene and her vast knowledge of his life and career. So, without further ado, here's my interview with Patricia Ward Kelly. Thank you for listening to Vanguard of Hollywood. I'm Shannon Allen. Today, I'm absolutely thrilled to be sitting amidst the Gene Kelly archives with film historian Patricia Ward Kelly. As Gene Kelly's wife and official biographer, Patricia brings a unique perspective to her work. No one knows Gene Kelly like Patricia, and she is the definitive source on all things relating to her legendary husband. In addition to finishing her book on Gene, Patricia has written and constructed two shows about her husband, which have played to sold-out houses around the world, and she was instrumental in bringing Gene's original 1960 ballet to the stage. Patricia is also a sought-after speaker on television shows, at film festivals, schools, and theaters around the world. Her written work has appeared in such well-known publications as The Huffington Post, The New York Times, and as the program note for Turner Classic Movies' 2012 Classic Film Festival. Patricia further keeps busy by preserving and cataloging the Gene Kelly Archives, an extensive collection of letters, manuscripts, photographs, scripts, interviews, essays, poems, and holograph notes relating to her husband that will eventually form the core of a virtual Gene Kelly experience. Patricia, thank you so much for speaking with me today. It's an honor to be here.
Oh, I'm so delighted you made the trek to be here. I think it helps to be in the midst of these things a bit.
It's amazing. I feel the essence of Gene Kelly here.
It's funny, a lot of young dancers come, especially from the UK, and often I'll find them outside. They'll just say it was a little overwhelming for them to see so many things, and particularly to see Gene's handwriting, that they just have to step outside for just a minute. And I do understand it. I get it. I think I'm so enmeshed in it. It's a different kind of experience for me, but I think coming into it, it can be fairly powerful.
Oh, yeah. Well, and it's a dream come true to admire his work on the screen for so many years and to now be seeing things in person. I never thought it would happen. So thank you. Thank you for your generosity.
You're very welcome.
Well, let's get started. I wanted to ask you initially, what was your life before Gene?
very different. I must say, I was thinking about it. It's kind of like before Gene and after Gene, because there was very little similarity. I was a very nerdy Herman Melville scholar. I was completely intent on being one of the top scholars in the world. There weren't a lot of women in the field, and I'd had the great fortune of working with some of the top Melville people at the Newberry Library in Chicago, where the Melville collection is held. And I was particularly focused on Melville's source material, and so I really studied in all of the libraries, and I would study his handwriting and tried to really understand his creative process. And I went to graduate school at the University of Virginia, again, for completely intending to go on. And I got hired out of there to work on documentary films, one about Melville. And then I was propelled out of that to work on a 90-minute television special about the Smithsonian Museum in Washington, D.C., And originally, the host narrator was to be a man by the name of Gregory Peck. And I had seen To Kill a Mockingbird. I didn't come from one of these families that go to the movies every weekend or watch them on television together. I just didn't experience that. But I had seen that. But at the last minute, they said that the host narrator was to be someone named Gene Kelly. And I know it sounds remarkable, but I honestly did not know who Gene Kelly was. And I didn't know if Gene Kelly was a man or a woman. And I really just needed the money to pay the rent. So I was perfectly happy to just do the work. And the director, who was a lovely man from England, could see that the women were dying to get a marriage proposal out of Gene, because he was one of the most eligible bachelors in the world at the time. And so he decided he would put me in the room with Gene to keep all the other women away from him. So I spent a week with him, never having a clue he was famous, and just listening to his stories. He was a beautiful storyteller. And he spoke French, he spoke Italian, read Latin, he spoke Yiddish, he wrote poetry, he was an economics major, he was a true Renaissance man. And so by the middle of the week, I have to admit, I was pretty enchanted by him. And my pet study in graduate school was etymology. It was word origins and poetry. And those just happened to be his pet studies. So we played word games and quoted poetry back and forth. And at the end of it, he gave me a little piece of paper with his phone number on it. And I gave him a piece of paper with mine. And he called me about 6 months later and asked me to come to California. And he said he had some writing projects, and so I came out never really having no clue what it would be, and I came out and he asked if I would stay and write his memoir with him. And so we ended up getting married 5 years into that process, but I recorded him nearly every day for over 10 years, and that's the spine of the book that I'm working to finish now.
I love hearing that Gene was an intellectual, loved words, and actually reminded me of a quote from Robert McNeil. It's about being wordstruck. He says, "Wordstruck is exactly what I was and still am. Crazy about the sound of words, the look of words, the taste of words, the feeling for words on the tongue and in the mind." Does that describe Gene to a T?
I'll have to get that from you. That is brilliant, because Gene was definitely word struck. And I would find him, he would sit in the chair in the corner, and very often he would just say a word over and over because he loved the sound of it. It would just be like cellar door, cellar door, cellar door. And one of them was funny because it was a restaurant here in Malibu called Gladstones for Fish. And there was an ad for it, and it would be Gladstones for Fish. And so Gene would sit there and say, "Gladstones for Fish, Gladstones for..." But he delighted in words. He was like a child. He always said that I was a perennial child. He loved words, and he loved hearing them. He loved learning them. He loved crossword puzzles and loved words in other languages. He felt it was, you honor the person. Say, if we were to go meet Václav Havel, the head of Czechoslovakia, Jean knew enough Czech to be able to communicate initially with him. And so he believed in languages, dance as the universal language, but then he believed in the languages so that you could communicate in other ways.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and what was that like juggling being his spouse and also recording everything? That couldn't have been an easy job.
It was quite funny. Jean was very funny. We'd be sitting there having dinner and he'd look over and he'd say, "You're not writing anything down." And I said, "Yes, I'm eating." And he was so disappointed in the accounts that were written about him, the books that came out, the quote biographies, and they were so full of misinformation. And so I think he felt telling his own story was the way to do it. But it was funny because we would go, we had a date every Saturday night. We went to Spago restaurant up on Sunset Boulevard, and we had a two-top table in the corner. And again, I'm writing everything down. And then we would go to, there was a piano bar at the Peninsula Hotel then. And it was kind of a wood paneled bar that was more like an East Coast bar or even a European bar than you would expect here in California. And early on, there we were often the only guests there. And so we just had this piano serenading us. And it would be the music, the American popular song of Gene's youth that he loved. Things like Jerome Kern, September Song, Smoke Gets in Your Eyes, Autumn Leaves. These beautiful melodies and songs, and he knew all of them. He knew all the words. And so we would be there, and as he'd begin to hear this music, it would trigger all these memories pouring out of him. And so I have half of what you'll see in the files here are notes on sugar packs and cocktail napkins, because he's suddenly pouring out these terribly romantic, penetrating stories. So I've recorded them, and they're on sugar packs.
Oh, that's amazing. Your dates at Spago must be some of your favorite memories with Jean. What are some of your other favorites? Times that you spent together?
Those are some of the favorite memories. The thing is, because I was working, one of the things that I've found as I've been putting everything in archival sleeves is I have the receipts for the meals that we had at Spago and other restaurants around the world. And so I can see what we ate and what we drank. And I have to say that I missed a lot of really great bottles of wine and things because I was trying to stay absolutely alert and record
right.
everything. And I'm thinking, oh, no. I mean, that was a priceless bottle of wine. So I think it was a choice. I had to. But now looking back, when I think about it, I think I'm really glad I have the words, because I have a pretty good memory. My recollection is pretty good. And what I find is that I will remember something that he and I did, but then I'll go into the files and I will find what I wrote down or what I recorded of that. And I have the exact words that what he said to me. And I remember the gist of it, but it's priceless to have the exact words. For example, I found only a few months ago the note that he left me the day we got married. And it says, "This is it. You're stuck. Love, love, love your new husband." And it hits you with an impact. I mean, when you see the handwriting and you have that note, I mean, it's powerful and it hits you right in your gut, but then the joy of having that preserved is amazing. So
yeah. Oh, well, there's another side of Gene. So he's this intellectual Hollywood legend. And you've mentioned previously that despite these more sophisticated aspects of his personality, some of his favorite foods were very down to earth. And tell me if I'm missing something here, but you've mentioned he loved fried bologna sandwiches.
Yep.
Boiled hot dogs.
Yep.
Cold mashed potato sandwiches.
Yep.
And chicken pot pies.
Yeah, you got them all
right.
Is that
the whole list?
Well, it's not the whole list, but that gives you a real good sense of his... I mean, this is hilarious because here's a guy who speaks fluent French. He can get along in any of the finest French restaurants where he was welcome. And yet, when I first came to visit him, we had boiled hot dogs with yellow American mustard. And then he wanted chicken pot pies the next day. And he liked the kind, he wasn't big on vegetables. So green things were not high on his list. And then I'll never forget, he's in the kitchen teaching me how the technique of how to flip a pot pie over onto, and I'm looking at him like, get in total disbelief that he's trying to teach me how to flip a pot pie, but I'll never forget it. And meanwhile, we're watching baseball, we're watching the preliminaries for the World Series. So on top of boiled hot dogs, he's describing the connection between classical ballet and baseball. So it's this, it's a world that you just can't even imagine, that he was knowledgeable in so many different things, and there were so many different aspects to his personality. But I do kind of love it. He and I kind of parted on those foods, though. That was not... I would be more in the salad category, and,
right.
and he was in the, but yeah, the cold mash. I've not yet had a cold mashed potato sandwich. It has onions and yeah, but there are aficionados who really claim to these things. But he was,
well, there you go.
He would also like coq au vin and things like that. So
he still had the sophisticated food taste.
But he never, the Pittsburgh in him always stayed as well. So
that's awesome. Well, another thing I wanted to ask you about during your life with Gene, you have mentioned that Swifty Lazar was your literary agent, that you guys would go out to dinner with Donald O'Connor and his wife. You met Frank Sinatra, who is one of Gene's very dearest friends. Who were some of the classic Hollywood legends you met who didn't disappoint in real life?
Ooh, that's a good question, because many of them did. You would be surprised. They're great up on the screen, but they're not that interesting, not that kind, not that decent. Gene was the whole package, which was really unusual, I think, in the sense of a man of such decency and integrity and brain power and humility. I think that was an unusual quality to see. I would say didn't disappoint. Gene said there were two people he would call in the middle of the night if he ever needed help, if he needed anything. And one of those was Frank Sinatra. And Frank was exceedingly kind to me and to Gene. But I think it was that old school, if you are honoring your friend, you honor the woman he's chosen to be with. And so Frank was very kind, especially at the end of Gene's life, to help me. And he did a lot of things completely without any fanfare. You would never know. It was completely anonymous. And he helped fly Gene back from San Francisco when Gene got sick up there. And I assumed Frank had a plane, and Frank rented a plane to get Gene back. And so that was an example of a true friendship. And then the other person Gene would call in the middle of the night was the director, Richard Brooks. And Richard was very bright. He used to say, for every word you write, read 10,000. And wrote some of the most brilliant scripts we have, and directed some of the greatest films, Blackboard Jungle, Lord Jim, Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, Sweet Bird of Youth, In Cold Blood. These are these big men in life, and Richard was a Marine and considered very tough, but he was just a sweetheart, and he came for dinner every Thursday night at our house. And the first 20 minutes, he would just grouse about things in the world, and he would eat a single onion. But he was a teddy bear, and the next morning I would find a single red rose on the front porch that he had sent. But again, Richard was very protective and of Jean and of me to be around these people, but they just came by the house. I mean, they were just friends. Leslie Caron, I have to say, I just saw her again in London a year and a half ago, and I spoke at the Victoria and Albert Museum, and she was in the audience, and I was a little bit, I thought, oh no, here I am, and she's going to be. But she came right up to me and came up to the stage right after, and I'd give anything if I had that recorded, because it was a profound distillation of Jean's contribution as a choreographer and director. And she always recognized Jean behind the camera, not just on the screen, but his contributions and the way he changed the look of dance on film and the way he had dancers coming in at an angle. And so I really give her a lot of credit, and I really appreciate these people who are gracious enough to acknowledge the contribution that Jean made to their careers. And she's been extremely kind and gracious about that.
And this is the perfect segue, because now I want to talk to you a bit about Jean as a dancer and what set him apart, because I danced growing up, and I still actually tap every day. But I realized at a very young age that I loved the classic Golden Age musicals. And I learned the dancers very quickly. Jean, Fred Astaire, Vera Ellen, Doris Day, all of them were wonderful, but Jean stood out. And of course, he's a phenomenal showman. That's something that really sets him apart. But as I've listened to you speak and read your words, I'm convinced that the reason he stood out was his involvement behind the camera. He was an expert on everything. Would you say that that is something that set him apart from his peers?
Oh, definitely. But also the fact that his determination to create a new American style of dance, to not, as a young man growing up in the Depression in Pittsburgh, also being an Irish Catholic who was ostracized for that. He was in a lower economic strata. And so he said, I don't want to dance like rich people. I want to dance like people I know and what represents me. But there was no model for that. So he said, how does that person dance? And how does the American male move? And so he looked and he thought, his only model was the sports that he loved, and that would be particularly baseball and hockey. And so if you look at the style of his dance, it's very broad, wide open steps, and very low to the ground. And so he was a trained classical ballet dancer. So there was a great emphasis on the long line of the body and the extension of the leg, and in wearing costumes that closely fitted his body to reveal it. But then once he had the line, he understood how you could break the line and bring it down and dance jazz. And so what he said to me was, he said he never really wanted to be a dancer, but he knew that he was the only one who could really execute what he wanted to do. And then he said, I'd like to be remembered for changing the look of dance on film. And he said, if anybody's going to do that, it'll be you, to get that word out. Because often I think the only way I can understand it is that he's such a big figure up on the screen that people forget he's behind the camera. He's directing, choreographing, he's creating what you see. Because a lot of times people say, did he ever choreograph anything? And I'm saying, yeah, just everything you just looked at.
Right.
So the style of dance, if you look at the movies that preceded Gene's movies, then they're very often the 30s and 40s musicals. The dance numbers you can virtually cut out of the film because it doesn't further the plot. Right. It's like they go along, the story goes along, then they go on to a dance number, and then they resume the plot. And Gene said, no, I want the dance to tell the story. I want the movement to convey the emotion. And I think Singing in the Rain is the iconic number is probably your best example of that, because what better way to say you're in love than to kiss the girl and wave off the taxi and then begin to splash in puddles and dance and sing in the rain. And so I think the people who preceded Gene, and even in Astaire is dancing a European style of dance, a ballroom dancing style. He and Ginger Rogers were obviously terrific at it. Gene said there were better ballroom dance teams, Velos and Yolanda and different people. They came to Hollywood, they tested, and the public didn't buy them, as Gene said. They didn't. There was something about Astaire and Rogers that the public loved. And Gene said, it's the public. The public chooses. And so why Gene became a star, someone like Donald O'Connor, Gene felt deserved much more attention, but the public never saw him in a romantic lead. Gene thought Vera Ellen, you mentioned Vera Ellen, as the best all-around female dancer, and yet, again, the public didn't quite get her as a romantic lead, and yet she knew every style of dance.
Oh,
so,
yeah.
And Gene loved Doris Day, obviously. He directed her in Tunnel of Love.
Right.
But it just kind of, I think, what happened before Gene, then Gene, and it did change things. But Gene often doesn't get the credit for that. And you'll hear about a Jerome Robbins, and you'll hear about a Bobby Fosse, but you don't get a Robbins and a Fosse without a Kelly. And Gene would, even when Gene was alive, he would look at lists of choreographers, and Robbins and Fosse would be on it, and no Kelly. And I think it was very hard for him, because he really felt that he had, his greatest contribution was in that and in the use of the camera. How do you capture dance? Here you have dance. Dance is a three-dimensional art form, but on the film you lose the third dimension. So how do you make dance not appear flat? So you see Gene is very often running at the camera, taking the camera into the streets, literally, and moving with the camera. So the camera is dancing and choreographed just as much as he is. And he creates a kind of kinetic sense of energy by coming at the camera. The higher he leapt, the more you got a sense of three dimensions and things with light and color and experimentation. So I'm always trying to make sure that his role behind the camera is kind of front and center, and because people are really shocked. And that's one thing in my shows. They come out and they say, gosh, I loved him before, but I love him even more. I had no idea how he was using dance and the camera.
Right. Well, I found an interview that Olivia Newton-John gave after Xanadu. And she mentioned in this interview the dance that they do together in that basically ballroom,
right,
living room of his home. She said, I'd never worked with anyone who was so prepared and so choreographed. She mentioned specifically, she said, not only did he choreograph the moves we were going to be doing, he told me exactly where the camera was going to be and how the camera was going to be moving with us. And she'd never experienced someone who was that prepared and that choreographed. It's so neat that that is something that Gene pioneered and brought to dance and brought to the screen.
You've done your homework exceedingly well. I've heard a lot of Olivia's interviews, but that's good to hear that she comments about that, because we need more voices talking about that, because it's gotten kind of lost and we need to bring it back. And he adored Olivia, and there was that talk about a mutual admiration. That was it. But it's exactly what she's saying, that he knew exactly where that camera was, and he knew that the camera was moving to musical beats, and he's moving to musical beats. So therefore, he knew he could coordinate what's coming off on the screen, because it was all controlled, and it's all controlled by music. So it's mathematical. Nowadays, they have video cameras. You can watch a playback. You can see if you got it. But back then, and he was shooting with one camera, and he said he edited in the camera, because how do you know if you got the shot? Well, the way he knew he got the shot was he had his assistants behind the camera. They'd count out the beats for the movement of the camera, and then they'd see if the camera hit its mark and Gene hit its mark, and then they knew they were in sync, and he knew. So it wasn't turned over to editors. It was he edited it and one camera. Now they're using 8-9 cameras. It's a lot of close-up shots of dance, which Gene and Fred Astaire never agreed to. They would only allow it head-on and full figure. Now you chop it up into body parts, and it means nothing. You see a head turning and feet, and you lose all the potency and the power of the dance.
And the choreography itself.
Yeah.
Well, something else I wanted to speak to you about, as a dancer, I loved Gene's explanation of the history of tap dance in his 1958 TV special, Dancing a Man's Game. Something that particularly struck me from the segment was him stressing that tap dancing evolved in America from the fusing together of different cultures and their traditions. And I have to quote him here because no one can say it better. He says, quote, "Tap dancing is like America itself. It's a real melting pot of the folk dances of several countries fused into its present form by jazz music. Beating your feet on the ground in rhythm has existed for centuries in every country around the world." He particularly highlights two groups that had the greatest influence on tap, the Irish immigrants and the African slaves in the American South. But the overall message that I hear from him is that tap belongs to every American because it borrows from every culture. And as such, it's a unifying force. Did Gene view tap and dance in general as a way to unite people?
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, he was the cultural ambassador to Africa in 1964. He was to go under President Kennedy, and Kennedy was assassinated, so he ended up going under Johnson. He was in Senegal, and he was watching the local dancers in Senegal perform for him, and then he did his own style of dance for them, and then he joined together, and they fused the different styles. And he said, essentially to them, what we have just done with dance transcends politics and economics, and it is the universal language. And I think he always had hoped that it would be a unifying thing. And it's interesting that you chose that about the history of tap, because again, sadly, in a lot of the books, when you read about tap, they ignore the different facets.
Yes.
They'll say it either only came out of the American South, or they'll say it only came out of Ireland, and miss this whole notion of fusing of cultures. Gene was so smart. Interestingly, he was in Chicago. He studied all forms of dance. He studied classical ballet and Spanish dance with Chicago dance masters in the 30s. And he was just like a sponge. He just wanted to absorb the history of dance. But primarily at that time, it wasn't in English. And so he went to the University of Chicago and read the history of dance in French. And he wanted to know what came before. And he felt that you needed to know what came before in order to take that and go create something new. And that's what he always said to dancers. I see a lot of dancers now. I'll get videos of people mimicking the number he did. They'll say, oh, here we're doing Moses Supposes or something. And Gene said, don't copy what I did. Take what I did and go beyond. Put your own thing on it.
Innovate.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Well, I wanted to ask you to do some myth busting with me, if you wouldn't mind. And of course, Singing in the Rain is the first film that comes to mind. So can I just ask you a few questions?
Sure.
Let's get the fact or fiction. So first question, definitive answer, in Gene's classic Singing in the Rain dance, was there milk in the water?
Absolutely not. There's no milk in the water. It's the most absurd concept, and I'm just shocked that it continues, because it's in books. It was apparently on the Universal tour for a while, and what it really is sublime cinematography and lighting, and it's it's backlighting the rain, which was very, very difficult, especially as Gene's dancing along in front of the plate glass windows. How do you backlight the rain and not show the equipment reflected in the glass? So I think it's time we give the cinematographers and the lighting people the credit and get rid of the milk, because you don't need milk to light up raindrops. You just need to light it right. And anybody who goes to a sports event and it starts to rain understands backlighting the rain.
So. Mm-hmm. There we have it. No more milk talk.
No more milk. Yep.
So another thing that we hear about Singing in the Rain, is it true that Gene was sick during filming of the big number, of the title number?
That is one of the few things that is true. He was very sick when he shot the iconic number. He had a temperature of about 103. And what I always remind people is to say, oh my gosh, you can't see it in his performance. And I always say, yes. And remember, he's choreographing and directing the scene. So the Rita Moreno, who plays Zelda in Singin' the Rain, when I went on the road with her for the 60th anniversary of Singin' the Rain, she said she went to the set, even if she wasn't in the scene, and she would watch. And she said Gene was in constant motion. He would be up on the boom watching the dance in, the person who's performing as a stand-in for him, watching them, setting the lights. He'd jump down, he'd go into costume and do the scene. And then she said he just moved constantly. And what he told me is that the whole set was draped in black tarpaulin. And so they had rigging hanging in the ceiling for rain to come down. And what he would do between takes is that he would go outside the black tarpaulin and just lie on the sidewalk and just try to bake the fever out of him and then come back in and do another take. And there were many takes because very often the lights back then were so hot, the bulbs would pop, or he might be going in front of the window and you did see the equipment there, they'd have to do it, or he missed a mark, or, you know, the infinite number of reasons why they would have to redo it.
Yeah, and so that's another thing. There's a myth that it was done in one take.
Absolutely not. And absolutely not. And you can see it. You can see, if you watch closely, you can see where there are cuts. He would tend to cut on a turn, so you don't notice the cut as much. And he didn't chop things up into chopped up body parts at all. So it's very subtle.
And with that dance, the title number, Singing in the Rain, he makes it look like just spontaneous, effortless, unchoreographed.
People say, well, you made it look so easy. And he said it was very difficult to make it look so easy because he wanted it to look like it was effortless, but it was all laid out, and he wrote it out like a writer. He wrote it out on the music or on yellow legal pads, and it was all thought out, the sequence of it. So yeah, very well thought out.
Now, I've read even down to the puddles. He had choreographed where the puddles of rain would be so that the stomping was exactly just right.
That's exactly right, because he had to hit each puddle, and they carved out the puddles. And then one time they came in and had to stop the camera, and they put sawdust in the puddles so that it would splash a little bit differently.
Oh, that's cool. All right, my next question for you. In her autobiography, Debbie Reynolds says that, quote, "Gene definitely hadn't wanted me as his co-star, but Louis V. Mayer himself had chosen me to play Kathy Seldon, and there was nothing Gene could do about it." Fact or fiction?
Absolutely fiction. Just beginning with the fact that L.B. Mayer was no longer head of the studio, and it was Dori Sherry, and so L.B. Mayer had nothing to do with the selection of Debbie Reynolds to play Kathy Seldon. And Gene told me that he was called into Arthur Freed, the producer's office. Arthur Freed called Gene up, and he showed him a little film clip of Debbie Reynolds singing with Carlton Carpenter, the Yabba Dabba Woo Woo kind of song. And Gene said, yeah, I think she's perfect to play the role. I think she'd be great. And so they called Stanley Donen up to look at the footage. And Stanley said, yeah, but can she dance? And Gene said, it doesn't matter. I can make her look like a dancer, which he could with anybody, essentially. And so they enlisted her and brought her in, and it was primarily his dance assistants, Carol Haney and Jeannie Coyne, who worked with her steadily during the day. And then Ernie Flatt taught her tap, who taught many of the great dancers.
Carol Burnett.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, fiction on all fronts on that one. Yep. Gene wanted her. He chose her. He's directing the picture. He chose each person. Everyone would say, well, who's your favorite partner? And he'd say, I don't have a favorite because I chose each person for the role that they played. And she was the perfect young person. And he said, and they're not interchangeable. You can't put Leslie Caron in Sing in the Rain, and you can't put Debbie in American in Paris. They're, and same with Sid. There's a myth about Sid Charisse being in American in Paris. No, absolutely. Gene wanted Leslie Caron. Never Sid, because it needed to be this gamine young dancer. And yeah. So, no, false.
Now, another thing Debbie says is that he didn't want Gene Hagen as Lena Lamont. How about that? Fact or fiction?
Total fiction. Interestingly, Gene chose Gene Hagen, and he felt Gene Hagen was the glue that held the picture together. And he told me that the only dispute he had with Arthur Freed and Stanley Donen was over the casting of Gene Hagen. That both Arthur and Stanley wanted women they felt were more glamorous than Gene Hagen. And so I have, here in the archive, I have photographs of Gene and Gene doing various tests and things to show. And because Gene said, once you dress her up and make her up, she's going to be perfect. And you can't even imagine that movie without Gene Hagen.
No.
I mean, she really is the glue and the humor and the... And what's so funny, what people don't even realize, is that Debbie Reynolds is supposedly dubbing Gene Hagen's singing voice, but in fact, that's a woman named Betty Noyce who's dubbing Debbie Reynolds' singing voice. And then Debbie Reynolds is supposedly dubbing Gene Hagen's speaking voice, but that's actually Gene Hagen's real speaking voice. So,
oh, that's great.
That very low voice is Gene Hagen's real voice.
Yeah. So it's Gene Hagen dubbing Debbie Reynolds, dubbing Gene Hagen.
Correct. Yeah. In a movie about dubbing, you would have no picture without Gene Hagen. So fortunately, Gene prevailed on that one.
Well, another question for you about Singing in the Rain. Debbie Reynolds says the Good Morning Number took 15 hours to shoot, and that when they were finally finished, I collapsed from exhaustion. My feet were bleeding from hours of abuse. Now, you spoke with Gene countless times about the film. Fact or fiction?
Well, Gene actually read that somewhere. I have him on tape saying he's kind of brushing off everything she said. It's fiction. It's all fiction. He kind of jokingly said, I never saw any blood on the floor. And one thing that you realize is that there are production notes. There are two sets of production notes. You have to remember that filmmaking was very much a business. And so they kept two different people who recorded what happened every minute of every day on the set. When a person arrives, when they go to lunch, when they go to the bathroom, when they tie, one will say Gene Kelly retied left shoe. And I'm not exaggerating that. I mean, everything is documented. And I went to it's the Arthur Freed collection at USC, and I went there to work for months and months. And it shows exactly how many takes, and it shows how long, how many days. But any time that doctors are ever called to a set or there's any kind of medical issue, it is documented. These films are so amazing in themselves. You don't need to add anything. And I don't think the stories actually add to them. I think the truth is actually more interesting.
Yeah. My next question for you. Debbie has called Gene a, quote, severe taskmaster, unquote. What did Gene say about descriptions of him as a taskmaster or a perfectionist?
Well, he always said to me, he said, I never understand when people would call him a perfectionist. He couldn't understand it because he said, I don't understand a professional who isn't a perfectionist. Why would you not be a perfectionist? And why has it taken on a kind of derogatory tone? And taskmaster, I think that again has a harsh tone to it. Somebody said to me once, consider the source. You have to really consider the source of the quote. So if you're talking to a dancer, a trained dancer, or a trained choreographer, they're never going to describe it that way because they know what it takes to hit that mark. And if they don't hit that mark and the camera doesn't hit its mark, you have to redo this. And that's money. That's time and money. And both were things that Gene would not waste. He never wasted time because he thought it was rude to waste somebody else's time. And he also wouldn't waste money. As a depression baby, you don't spend money because you can. You don't waste money. So I think he was tough and he demanded everybody hit their marks. He demanded that they do their best. But he was right there demanding the same of himself and in many cases much more. So I think it's like, oh, he was such a taskmaster. Well, you immediately conjure this image of a
right.
harsh, abusive, mean. He was not a mean person. He was not there was nothing gratuitous about what he was asking. He knew what it took to make that number happen in front of the camera. And maybe, just maybe, that's why we're watching these movies 70, 75 years later.
Yes. I mean,
Gene always, he said he was tough, but tender. And that's the man that I knew.
And you know, that's what Leslie Caron says too. So we talk about considering the source. Debbie is an untrained dancer. This is her first time in a rigorous dance environment. Leslie Caron is a ballerina with a prestigious company in Paris. She gets what it's like to work hard. Her take on Gene's directorial style and rehearsal was very different than Debbie's takeaway. So consider the source. The source.
You have to, I think.
One more question on Singing in the Rain. So Debbie says, aside from falling down with exhaustion, we had a happy time on the set. Everyone worked well together. What were Gene's thoughts? What did he say about the overall experience of Singing in the Rain?
He said it was a tremendous collaborative experience. So he never, again, he didn't take credit. He said that he was in front of the camera, but it's the Betty Comdens and Adolph Greens and the people behind the scenes who made him look his best. And so the Bill Saraceno, who's there working to record the taps after and to add a squish sound for water so that Gene would sound authentic, and the musicians, the composers, the arrangers. He was grateful. He knew it took a village to make it happen.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, switching gears. So this week I found Gene's inanimate object sketch that he does with Dean Martin on The Dean Martin Show. And I almost died laughing. It was so funny. His facials, his reactions to Dino's dialogue. I mean, it is fabulous. And listeners who have not seen the sketch, go find it. It is wonderful. But it got me thinking, one of the reasons why I think that sketch is so funny is because you feel like as you're watching Gene's reactions, this is how he is in real life. He must be this fun to hang out with. What is it like for you watching him in his television appearances, in his films? Is there a scene or a show where you look at him and you just say, I know that face, I know that laugh, that is him in real life?
There are several. There are little bits and pieces because he used to make me laugh. I would fall on the floor laughing. I mean, I would just be, and it wasn't like stand-up comedy stuff. It was just these funny faces and gestures. There are a couple that you wouldn't associate automatically. And one is in Invitation to the Dance, where he's dressed in the blue clown costume and he has the little bells on his hands.
Right.
that's Gene. Those little gestures are Gene, the way he would, what he would do with me. When I watch Dean and Gene, it's hilarious because those guys were very funny. These guys were Dean and Frank, and these are the boys, you know. Gene and Frank got each other. We'd go to dinner over at Frank's house and they'd crack each other up. But Gene wasn't a guy, he wasn't a guy who would go into a room and make everybody laugh. He was not that. There were many of them in Hollywood who would do that. Gene wasn't that. He was very quick, had a quick, quick wit. He was very sharp and he knew and he could be very charming. He'd almost like more like the Nina, that kind of swagger thing. For me, it's not so much the comedy, it's that, it's the smile, the, it's that genuine twinkle that came out of his eye and that, you know, the kind of turn of his head. And even the Muppet Show is very hard for me to watch as he walks off. You know, it's but it's more his kind of little, and when he would come on stage and he had a little fillip of a little movement with his leg or a little bit of a curtsy, even as he would come on stage, like on a Johnny Carson show, just little tiny things.
Oh, that's sweet. Well, you've written, constructed, and developed two shows on Gene. You've also been instrumental in getting his 1960 ballet up and performed. Can you tell me what was the inspiration behind these shows and making these happen?
Part of it is the same inspiration for my saying yes to talking to you, which is that I think Gene out there, a lot of people love him. They see him up on screen. He's terrific. They kind of think they know him. They think that he'd be fun to have a beer with or something, but they don't know very much about him. And in many ways, I think he gets sort of pigeonholed as this kind of dancer guy. They're stunned. People are stunned that he had this immense brain and that he was so articulate and so talented in so many different areas. So I just have enjoyed creating these shows that kind of subtly take people on this journey into his heart and his mind, and they begin to understand him and they understand his devotion to his craft and they understand the magnitude of his mind. And people come out saying, I loved him before, but I love him even more now. I had no idea about him. I love sharing the stories. I'm a ham. I love telling the stories and engaging with people, bringing people in, because they might see him in something and love him, but let's go on a deeper journey. And so that's why I greet people as they arrive. I stay after to shake hands, and I stay in touch with people if they write me a note. And I do not sing and I do not dance. I leave that entirely to him, and you'll be very grateful that I do that.
Well, Gene was a true Renaissance man, both intellectually and in his work as a dancer, director, choreographer, as a man who wore so many hats. How do you think he'd like to be remembered?
Well, certainly as all of those, but I think as the Renaissance man and all that comes with that, and as a decent man with integrity. Gene was always looking out for the underdog. He never was championing the richest football team, or it was the underdog. And he might not say that that's how he wanted to be remembered, but that's how he wanted to be remembered.
Yeah. Well, one final question for you, Patricia. We share the common goal of wanting to preserve the truth and rich history of the Golden Age, which Gene was so formulative in shaping. I've been asked, why does preserving this history in these classic films matter? And you are so articulate, as listeners have undoubtedly concluded. How would you answer that question in regards to Gene? Why does the Gene Kelly legacy matter?
It's interesting because early on, after Gene died, several people came up to me and they said, why are you doing this? Why are you trying to finish a book about him? Why do you care? Well, A, I was entrusted with it. Gene chose me. He brought me to California. He gave me the privilege of recording him every day for 10 years. He gave me the privilege of this stewardship of his belongings, his photographs, letters, his words. And I think I have a responsibility in that. I think it's like anyone who is in a position of stewardship. And I've always felt that, that all the things that you're sitting amidst here, okay, I own them. But I only believe that I'm to care for them and to make them accessible to people around the world and with hope in perpetuity. And I think Jean's legacy is important on so many levels, not only for classic film and for the history of classic film and for his immense contribution to the history of classic film and dance on film, but I think also for the type of man he was, I think it's also important that people understand that you can be one of the most famous people in the world and you can still be decent and caring and respectful, and you can go for the underdog, and you can value your art, and you cannot take your stardom for granted. I speak in a lot of high schools, and a lot of the kids are participating in the Gene Kelly Awards in the Pittsburgh area, and many of them will go on in the performing arts, but many won't. But they will take those lessons with them. So if anything I do gives them the strength through the experience of Gene's legacy, that yes, it's the right thing, and yes, carry your head high and be proud and be humble and go forward. And if I can touch one person, I will have considered that valuable.
That's beautiful. Well, Patricia, thank you so much for sharing your memories of Gene, your unique experiences with him, and for graciously allowing us to conduct this interview amidst the archives.
Well, thank you for reaching out and for doing your homework, because not everybody does, and it's a reciprocal experience. So you did your homework, so you brought a lot more to this than we could have had you not. So I'm very grateful and appreciative of that. So we'll do it again.
Oh, that means the world to me. Thank you. Yes, let's definitely do this again. For delicious recipes and all things classic Hollywood, visit my website, vanguardofhollywood.com. And if you enjoyed this podcast, please leave a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening from.